Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Legatum Institute Foundation, part of the Legatum Group, which headquarters at Dubai spans the world with its philanthropic determination to enable more people to lead lives that are more prosperous. My name is Howard Williams, and I'm the special advisor at the Legatum Institute, and as such, I look after our program on the culture of prosperity. And part of that program deals with the roads to freedom, which is why we are here this afternoon. In the roads to freedom, we look at various obstacles that have arisen on those roads in recent decades, and look at ways of removing such obstacles to liberty, both individual, corporate, or national. In this afternoon's seminar, we'll be looking at the constitution of freedom, the great question of why some constitutions succeed, while others fail. And right at the outset, perhaps just a quick historical reflection on why we are here assembled. In the history of the kingdoms of Scotland, and England, and of Ireland, like those of the various kingdoms and principalities that have emerged from the territorial landmass that we now call Wales, the history of the impact of our nearest neighbours, the French, has been profound. 800 years ago, at the Battle of Bouvines, an Anglo-German territorial force, yes, there was once such a thing, was defeated by King Philippe of France, hereafter known to history as the August, Philippe Auguste, because of the magnificence of his extension of the French royal domain. King John, known to history thereafter as the Bad, so bad indeed that there would not be King John II, returned to England to lick his wounds and to extract various forms of money from his territorial nobility, the barons. To the reaction against those royal demands that led to the First Barons' War 800 years ago, as autumn turned to winter. And at Runnymede, 1215, 799 and a half years ago, a Magna Carta was signed. The Magna Carta that would, in a year's time, be known as the Magna Carta Libertatum, the great charter of the liberties enjoyed by the king's subjects. Not, of course, all of the king's subjects. We're here talking about barons, freemen. Nothing in that document about serfs, let alone villeins. And much of the constitutional history of England thereafter rested indeed on a good deal of anachronistic interpretations of what Magna Carta was all about. We are dealing with an aristocratic society and the rights enjoyed by nobles. But the extension of Magna Carta's principles, such as the right to trial, the right to justice exercised by the king's justiciars, these became enshrined in various interpretations of that great charter. Specifically so in the Petition of Right of 1628, the American Constitution, and various other constitutional formulations. So our concern here today is with the world as we have it, and how constitutions give expression to individual rights, and the future of such constitutions on the roads to freedom. We're going to begin, as you'll see on our programme, with considerations of the Anglo-American world and its interpretation of the constitutional tradition. Last week, we had a specially convened conference on the future of the United Kingdom, following reports that had reached us of turbulence in the northern beaches of the But this afternoon, we will not be thinking so much about that. We'll be thinking about the nature of the United Kingdom's relationship to the European Union, a question that has dominated our domestic politics in the past half century. And to begin with, to offer us his introductory remarks and thoughts, we have Vernon Gotter, now firmly established among us as a great friend of the Legatum Institute. He was with us conference last week, and his wonderful talk on Sir Edward Grey in 1913-14 was part of an earlier series that we were able to host here on the world in 1913-14. And Vernon is going to be starting us off with a few thoughts about the nature of Britain's cross-channel relationship to the thing that we call the European Union. He, like all the other introductory speakers, will give us a talk lasting about between 9 and 10 minutes. And then, because this is a seminarian occasion, you're all going to take part.
Well, thank you for that generous introduction, Howell. A couple of brief comments about why some constitutions survive and some fail. And it seems to me that this is due less to intrinsic virtues or defects that constitutions have than to various features of the societies in which they operate. And in particular, that a constitution is unlikely to survive if it's the product of one dominant ideology when there are others in a society. For instance, in France, where you had deep divisions between left and right, and between Catholics and secular, the Third and Fourth Republic constitution in particular were held to illustrate the dominance of the secular groupings in society. And similarly in Germany, you had deep disagreements on the form of the state. So there's an ideological dimension to the survival of constitutions. And also what one may call a tribal dimension, that where a country is deeply divided by ethnicity, as Ukraine, or religion, as Northern Ireland, or language in Belgium, you have a difficulty because what we think of as the Westminster model does not work, because you have a permanent majority and a permanent minority, and no such society, to my knowledge, has ever been stable without a partnership or power-sharing constitution, consociation or constitution, whatever you call it, which gives the minority a share in power with the majority. And I think what's happening in Ukraine is showing that a winner-take-all solution cannot work in those countries. I was involved a few years ago in drawing up the constitution of Kosovo, which we tried to exemplify that principle in how they operated. But the difficulty, as we've seen from the history of Northern Ireland, is not to set up a constitution. I mean, that's easy, but the difficulty is to get people to work it in practice. You can easily draw up a constitution. You have to persuade people to live under it. And perhaps constitutions themselves are less important than we think, but the basic and obvious point is, if people want to settle, they will settle. If not, they will fight. I think a very good example of a constitution in those countries, in a country of that sort, which has survived for a long time, is that of Switzerland, which until 1848 was the Ulster of Europe. It endless squabbles, both on a linguistic basis and fundamentally on a religious basis. And in the 1840s, the Catholic cantons broke off and were forcibly conquered by the Protestant cantons in the Sonderbund Wars. But for some reason, which I'm not clear about, the Protestant cantons conciliated the Catholic cantons once they'd been conquered, quite different from Northern Ireland since the 1920s, and established a federal constitution with power sharing, which all groups share in government, which is really the opposite end of the spectrum of the Westminster model, because you have no government in opposition, but all the major political parties are in government. And if ever a new force comes up, as the socialists did in the first part of the 20th century, they're co-opted into the government itself. So there is no opposition. The government represents 70% of parliament. The opposition, Her Majesty's opposition to the referendum, the barriers, the people, to try and get legislation through the people. And the Swiss are successful because they have a genius, I don't know how they got it, for defusing tensions, which is very useful, really. I'm beginning to think that we are getting a genius for intensifying tensions rather than defusing them, and that our system now does intensify them. This was clear in the recent Scottish referendum, where everybody pointed out the fact the Conservatives have no representation in Scotland. In fact, they won 1/6 of the vote in the last general election, 2.5% less than the SNP, but have only one seat out of 59. And similarly, the Conservatives, although the largest party by far, have no seats at all in Birmingham, Hull, Leeds, Liverpool, Manchester, Newcastle or Sheffield. This doesn't mean no one votes for them in those seats, but they're not represented. And similarly, the Labour Party has no seats, in effect, south of the Wash 7 line, if you exclude London's got 10. And the way our system now works, I think, tends to intensify rather than reduce tensions. Now, the main theme of this part of the conference is the relationship between Britain and Europe. And, of course, Europe does have a constitution, which is the Treaty of Rome as amended. which is again almost at the opposite pole from the Westminster Constitution, because it has no single sovereign institution, but is based on the principle of the separation of powers and the judicial review of legislation, which are principles alien to our own system of government. And the principle of separation of powers is exemplified in Europe, both in its central institutions and the division of power between the community and the union and the member states. In the union, constitutional authority is divided between the Council of Ministers, the Commission, the Court of Justice, and the European Parliament. And of course, that goes against our view that parliamentary sovereignty should be continuous and undivided, no parallel to that on the continent. And indeed, because of that principle, we don't have a written constitution. I mean, I blame my old university for this, Oxford, because the principle of parliamentary sovereignty is an Oxford principle. I mean, first drawn up by Hobbes, then Bentham, Dicey, Austin, and others. And I think they're really to blame for it all. And we see Parliament quite differently from the continental view, because we see Parliament as being there to sustain an executive. Of course, the European Parliament isn't such an animal. Its role is to sustain a dialogue with other European Union institutions, the Commission and the Council of Ministers. Well, the House of Commons is fundamentally a debating chamber dominated by a dialogue between government and opposition. But in the European Union, legislation is not being proposed by a government, nor attacked by an opposition. And legislation doesn't conform to the binary type of politics we used to at Westminster. It's a multi-party parliament operating through a dominant coalition, which is usually Social Democrat and Christian Democrat. And that's reflected in the architecture of the two parliaments. I mean, Westminster's rectangular, the European Parliament semicircular. So, incidentally, is the Scottish Parliament. So parliamentary processes are quite different. And we also, of course, until devolution, we were a profoundly unitary and centralised state, resistant to federalism. And the dominant part of the state, England, is still like that, because England prepared to accept devolution for non-English parts, but herself resists very strongly both devolution and, of course, federalism for herself. So it's very difficult for us to understand how Europe works. And in particular, I think the European Commission, which seems to us a curious hybrid, because it's making political decisions but is not directly elected. And we take the view that those who have the right to make political decisions should be elected, and that those who are not elected are civil servants who are non-partisan and non-political. And I was once at a meeting a few years ago where there was a European Commissioner speaking, he's no longer alive, called Finn Gundelach from Denmark, and a Conservative MP referred to him as an official, and he bristled. And I think Jacques Delors bristled even more strongly, and Mr. Juncker even more strongly. But the British view is that you have power to make political decisions only if you are elected. And it's this tradition which puts us against Europe, our thinking in terms of undivided sovereignty, which is not there in Europe. And therefore, we say that sovereignty must lie somewhere, either with Westminster, which means a Europe de patrie, and no overriding legal system, or in Brussels, which means what Hugh Gateskill once called the end of a thousand years of history. And it's very difficult to grasp the division and sharing of power between different units so that each performs a different task. And the question about Europe, and I conclude on this, the question is whether we can change. And it was first raised by the French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman in 1950 when the Coal and Steel Community came up. And he said that the countries joining it had in common a common European destiny. Now, is Britain part of that destiny? One French president thought we might be, President Pompidou of France, De Gaulle's successor. When he negotiated with Edward Heath our entry into Europe, he gave a press conference and said he'd asked Mr. Heath what he thought of Europe. In other words, whether Britain was really determined to become European, whether Britain, which is an island, was determined to tie herself to the continent, and whether she was prepared consequently to loosen her ties with the open sea towards which she has always looked. And Pompidou gave Edward Heath's response, saying, "And I can say that the explanations and views expressed to me by Mr. Heath are in keeping with France's concept of the future of Europe." You may think that last comment is somewhat ambiguous. At least a European commitment does not follow from our traditional understanding of our constitution, and it involves a radical discontinuity of approach which we may or may not be able to adopt. I think the book is still open. But for the moment, perhaps the best comment on Europe was that made at the very beginning of the enterprise by Ernest Bevin, when he said that Britain should not join the European Coal and Steel Community, because he said if you open that Pandora's box, you never know what Trojan horses will jump in.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Bevin, for that Pandora's box at the bottom of which we found Edward Heath and Sir Pompidou, both Tweedledum and Tweedledee of European politics at their time. And so there are 13 exemplifications of the Charter of 1215. Just four of these survive, and happily all four are in Britain, two in the British Library, one in Lincoln, and the other in Salisbury. Various other copies made and reissued in the course of the 13th century. One of these being reissued by King Edward I, and it is that particular copy which is in the possession of Sir David Rubinstein, whom we hope to welcome to this institute next year. Now, the influence of the Charter itself and the various interpretations of the Charter, as I was saying earlier, have been profound in the making of the American mind and in the making of the American Constitution. And there is nobody who is more expert and learned and more able to communicate those truths and the relationship to present-day American politics, which preoccupies all of us greatly, than Tony Badger. Now, if Vernon has lately been liberated from tutelage to the wickedly intellectual influence of the University of Oxford, Tony Badger has been liberated from the University of Cambridge. And has moved north to Northumbria University, where the countryside is rather more agreeable in its surroundings than Fenland. We're delighted to be able to be with us this afternoon to offer his thoughts on the Constitution of the United States and its impact on responsibility for, or possibly entire absence of responsibility for, gridlock in Washington.
Thank you, Harlan. Thank you very much for this invitation. And I should say that after almost 50 years of being an American historian, I have spent most of my time very infrequently talking about the Constitution. So I'm very singularly inexpert on those issues, but about gridlock in Washington, I perhaps know a bit more. In 2012, two political scientists wrote a wonderful book called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the Politics of Extremism. And they blamed the excessive partisanship in a constitutional system which provided for the separation of powers and divided government. Their target, even though one of them was very conservative, their target, the villains, were primarily ideologically extreme Republicans. And they highlighted as Exhibit 1 the fact that eight Republican senators had co-sponsored a bipartisan move to tackle the problem of entitlements. And then when it came to the vote, none of them voted for it. the outcome in 2012 and the outcome in the recent midterms and the current debate in Washington, particularly about immigration reform, suggest that their rather gloomy view of American current American politics has been strengthened rather than weakened. What I wanted to remind people was that the Jeremiads about the unworkability of the American Constitution and system of government have a long history. I have some quotes from Woodrow Wilson. It's quite safe to say that were it possible to call together again the members of that wonderful constitutional convention to view their work in the light of the first century that has tested it, they would be the first to admit that the only fruit of dividing power has been to make it irresponsible. You can go to the eve of the New Deal, you can go to World War II, you can go to James McGregor Burns writing in 1960 about the deadlock of democracy, and you have these wonderful statements about how gloomy the future is going to be and how impossible it is to work the American system. And each of these Jeremiads has in fact preceded a period of extraordinarily rich and constructive legislative activity in the United States. And it also reminded me that, again, I started work as a graduate student in 1968, and the idea of divided government was very unusual. when you, the previous 48 years in America, only 6 years had there been a president and Congress of different parties. Whereas if you now look back 48 years, it's the other way around. I think it's 10 years at most in which there has been undivided government. Divided government is the norm. And on the whole, there have been periods when divided government has worked perfectly satisfactorily. And the other point I was going to make in terms of historical context is that it's perhaps sanitary to remember as we look at President Obama's leadership at the moment, it's sanitary to remember that no president in America since the Civil War has enjoyed a successful elected second term. So there are considerable, the judgment, the bar we set for judging American government and its efficacy is often quite high. But there's no doubt that the polarization of politics in the United States and the gridlock that exists in the United States and the degree of partisan polarization is probably worse than it has been for a very long time. And what I was really wondering, looking at today, was really, is this something that you can point the finger at the Constitution about? Or does it reflect, as we've talked about, wider institutional and cultural issues? And my feeling is that on the whole, when you look at what's going wrong in the United States at the moment, that actually the Constitution has very little responsibility for it. It's not really an issue about the Constitution. It's really an issue about ideological diversity and polarization. We can dismiss very briefly, I think, the question of the president's responsibility. We have a president who is actually not very good. His awkward combination of bluster and negotiation is not very well suited to divided government. The failures of divided government in the last few years are pretty clear. The delay in passing his economic stimulus package, repeated desire to hold the government to ransom over fiscal default or over the fiscal cliff. These have been highly irresponsible and difficult for the government to cope with. The New York Times wrote, "The fiscal cliff is a granddaddy of a suicide vest. This is Congress deciding to jerry-rig the system. It's going to attach an explosive to the federal budget. And if they don't act like adults and make mature, difficult decisions by a certain date, the whole place is going to blow up." Well, of course, Congress did not make mature or difficult decisions. But then you can go to immigration reform, you can go to gun control, and you have this fact that seldom has politics been so paralyzingly divided on partisan lines. One indicator of this is the use of the filibuster. The filibuster used to be the preserve of either the Southern racists or the Southern white supremacy Democrats, or it used to be the preserve of the occasional lone progressive like George Norris trying to halt legislation. As Harry Reid pointed out, Lyndon Johnson only faced one filibuster in 6 years. Harry Reid has faced in 6 years 386 filibusters. And so this shows the way in which it's difficult to get the sort of bipartisan working of Congress. The fact that you now routinely assume that you need a 60 seat majority or 60 votes in the Senate to pass anything is something that would a previous generation of Americans would have regarded as inconceivable. When I interviewed people who were in the Senate in the 1970s, they remember a very different sort of politics. They say, well, our job was to make laws, it was to make compromises. To get laws and compromises, you had to work across the aisle, and they contrast it with what they see as largely symbolic politics of today, in which your legislators are looking for hot-button issues like abortion or gay marriage, issues on which both it's very difficult to get agreement, and secondly, or actually on which the legislature can scarcely meaningfully act, because in fact it's going to be decided in the courts in any case. As for working across the aisles, one South Carolina Republican candidate summed up a different view of working across the aisles. The only purpose to work across the aisles, he said, is to headbutt your opponent. a policy advisor to the Republicans, sadly noted, I used to think that it would take a global financial crisis to get both parties to the table, but we just had one. These days I wonder if this country is governable. What are the dynamics, what are the institutional sources of this polarisation, or the strengthening features behind the polarisation? Redistricting, the fact that there are so few competitive elections in the United States. North Carolina is one of the most competitive states in the nation. And in this recent Senate election, 2 points divided the two senatorial candidates. And yet, if you look at the number of the House of Representatives, it goes 10-3 for the Republicans, the state legislature much the same. And there was not a single congressional election in North Carolina this year except the Senate race. But the races for the House, the 15% was the narrowest margin of victory in that. So we have a situation where all politicians on both sides basically cater to their party base, and their party base is a lot more extreme than the public at large. One of the other factors here, the erosion of public trust in government. 1963, 75% of Americans believed that you could trust the federal government to do the right thing. Now the figure is under 10%. Religion, I think, has had a very malign effect since the energization of evangelicals and the moral majority in the 1970s. It's created a dynamic that is very difficult to contend with. Money, the North Carolina Senate race recently cost $110 million. So we can go through this sort of why you have this gridlock. Does it matter? And there, I think, the question is much more fluid. If you look at the issues facing the United States, whether they're in foreign policy, or dealing with the problem of entitlements, or dealing with the energy crisis, I don't think the problems facing the United States are problems that are made difficult by gridlock or by the Constitution. They're problems made possible by democracy. That they're actually very different. They're very difficult problems to solve. Whether you're dealing with particularly any problem that requires people to pay short-term costs for long-term gains, as Galbraith would have put it. So in conclusion, it is even worse than it looks, but it always has been. And I think the Americans will muddle through in much the same way, and muddle through rather successfully.